stay tuned for Making Waves.
Good evening and welcome to WJFF's Making Waves, a radio magazine made up of many voices, many volunteer producers, and many topics of interest in our listening area. Kevin Greff is executive producer for Making Waves. Theme music for Making Waves is composed and performed by Cindy Rickmond. My name is Jared Levine. I'll be your host for tonight. Tonight on Making Waves, in our Kingfisher Project segment, we'll talk to Patty Strack and Katie Zuber, researchers from the Rockefeller Institute of Government. Patty and Katie are conducting a study throughout New York State, including Sullivan County, concerning the opioid epidemic. Their research will help design policy at state and federal levels. Then we'll be talking with photographer Rich Klein about his exhibit at Liberty Museum and Art Center of Firefighters in the Catskills. This will be followed by an interview with Jeff Doolittle of Eric Banger and the Mashers Irish Folk Band that will be performing at St. John's Episcopal Church in Ellenville, New York on February 22nd at 7:30 p.m. And we'll start with the Kingfisher Project, information and awareness about the addiction epidemic.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project. The Kingfisher Project is a community and information radio project based here at WJFF. The project was established in 2014 in honor of my daughter Rebecca Pizzol, who was shot and killed in a heroin-related incident. The project is named for the injured bird Rebecca wrote about while she was in high school, about her philosophy of life. At her memorial service, her teacher, Mr. Ogazalek, read the essay, and a few days later, he read the essay on Making Waves. Since then, a number of people decided they wanted to remember Rebecca by doing something that would be useful. That is how the Kingfisher came to be at WJFF. And now tonight on the air, we have Patty and Katie. And Patty is the Deputy Director of the Research at the Rockefeller Institute of Government and an Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration and Policy at the University of Albany. And Katie is the Assistant Director for Policy and Research at the Institute and a Visiting Professor in the Political Science Department at Skidmore College. And thank you for being with us, Patty and Katie.
Thanks for having us.
And I first met you when you came to Sullivan County to the task force meeting at Public Health. And we didn't know who you were. So I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about yourselves and also particularly why you have an interest in your research in Sullivan County.
Sure. Let me start off by saying that we are interested, like many people, in the opioid epidemic that's hitting the country, and our specific interest in New York State. And so we were interested in understanding how the problem works. Now, the difficulty that researchers, that policymakers run up against is that it's a big problem, but nobody really knows what works or even really what it looks like. So we decided to go into a community, and we chose Sullivan for a number of reasons, and to learn more from the people on the ground about what the problem looks like and what kinds of solutions would best help it. Because I think sitting in an office in Albany, New York, and looking at aggregate data doesn't really get at the st- story of how things look on the ground and what the problems are that communities are facing that they're not able to deal with by themselves. So kind of the things that policymakers should be looking at but maybe aren't.
Okay. And so you came down to Sullivan County because our overdose rates are higher or because of...
The overdose rates are higher. Sullivan County actually looks like a lot of other counties, both in New York and in the United States, high overdose rates, high death rates. And so we wanted to get a sense of what that looks like in communities, rural communities like Sullivan.
And I know that this is a research project, and Anthony Warren and I met with you one day at the Liberty Diner, and I believe you've met with other people in Sullivan County at diners. And you ask us questions, and we were wondering about the survey that you're doing. You're going to write policies about that, or put it in for maybe change of policies in New York State?
Well, actually, what we're trying to do is we're trying to talk to people and get a sense of what's going on and what the problem is and what kind of help they would like to see. And then we're going to move up the ladder and look at what policymakers at the state and federal level are doing to get a sense of the kinds of policies and policy programs that they want to put in place at all address the problem that folks on the ground say that they're dealing with. So what we're trying to do is to connect the voices and the people and the real life experiences on the ground with what policymakers are doing.
And what are you finding? I mean, I know I had a lot to say and Anthony had a lot to say, but is there one thing in general one that you're finding is the same?
We are actually coming up with a lot of interesting findings. Some of them are not so interesting to people in the county because they seem obvious. The number one finding that people we've spoken with is that transportation is an issue. So when we talk about treatment and when we talk about how to address the problem, whatever policy solutions come into place, transportation has to be a key issue in terms of getting people the help that they need and making sure they have access to the resources. So in a New York City, difficulty with access might mean not having enough money to get the services or that you need. But in places like Sullivan, it might be that they're not available or that you're unable to actually physically get to them. So understanding how policy solutions that might work in Albany or New York City or Buffalo don't necessarily work in places like Sullivan.
And that's another one of the reasons why we're looking at Sullivan County, because people tend to think of drug epidemics as being a uniquely urban problem. But when we go into Sullivan County, we see that many of the policies or solutions that would normally be tailored to a city won't necessarily work in a place like Sullivan County. And since we expect that Sullivan County is representative of a lot of other counties that are experiencing this, we think that we have a lot to learn from being on the ground there.
Patty, this is Jared Levine with the Kingfisher Project. I was going to ask you, actually, what was one thing that you found that you perhaps didn't expect or that people may not associate with the opioid epidemic at first glance? And certainly transportation counts for that. So I'm not going to ask you that again, but I do wonder, is it too early in your research to have perhaps set your sight on some sorts of solutions, say either for more widespread treatment options or for the transportation issue? Do you see any possible outs in these areas?
I wish I had the solution. We don't have that yet. The kinds of things that we've seen, I mentioned transportation. There's issues with social services that we've seen as well, so foster care, problems that crop up in the schools as a result, not only with kids who might have drug addiction problems, but their parents or guardians who might have problems. We've also seen issues arise in other areas, too. So we see transportation, we see social services, we see health services. And one thing that we were surprised to find out is that the number of beds in Sullivan County to address drug addiction have shrunk at the same time that the problem is growing. So looking at the incentives that health insurers and that Medicaid provide to people to treat drug addiction, how those don't necessarily keep up with the kinds of services that doctors are willing to provide. So that was like a third issue that we had expected. And then the second part of your question again?
I'm not sure. I think you answered it pretty succinctly. That is a catch-22, though, isn't it, that the number of beds essentially goes down as the number of people in crisis who need those beds goes up. And I imagine that Sullivan isn't unique in that regard. We've all heard stories about either other places in New York State or throughout America where the statistics bear out that it's potentially worse, although that's kind of a dubious comparison to make because we're talking about human lives. But I wonder, were you surprised by the amount of issues that are inherent here in Sullivan? Is it really that much more different from other areas, at least in New York State, that you've seen?
No, I don't think Sullivan is that different than other areas in New York State that we've seen. I think the difference is that the way that people talk about drug addiction in Albany, for example, the kinds of conversations we hear here are very different than the way that people talk about it in Sullivan. And here, so state policymakers, state officials talk about drug addiction in terms of this is a problem with drugs and getting people treatment for drugs. And there's less of a focus on all the other kinds of things that go into successful treatment, like transportation, like the social services, like the shrinking number of beds that are available to treat people. So it's just seen, you know, more narrow and more tractable, kind of easier to solve than it is on the ground when folks are really trying to scramble to find a way to make solutions work.
And I know I had mentioned transportation to you for Sullivan County, and then you said social services. And is social services just unique to Sullivan County, or I'm sure that's more widespread, correct, throughout New York State?
That's more widespread, too. It's just that we hadn't thought, you know, we're going in to study opioids. We hadn't thought, well, we should talk to the foster care system. And we should talk to the schools, and that's exactly what we're finding, that it isn't a problem that stays in a drug addiction box or in a health box even, that it spills out into lots of other areas. So lots of people's lives are affected by this, and a lot of, people working to provide services, social services, transportation services, health services, education services are affected too. So it just trickled, it just spilled over to lots of other areas, which I don't think we had realized when we started.
And have you gone into the schools and the social services? Have you talked to them as well in Sullivan County?
We have talked to a couple of the social services people, and our next kind of couple of trips down to Sullivan County, we have plans to talk to some of the educational people. So, you know, we've been told to talk to guidance counselors, which was one of those kinds of things that had kind of initially caught us off guard. And then we also plan to go back and do a little bit more to talk to folks in law enforcement and some of the first responders in Sullivan County, in addition to education and also some additional healthcare providers.
And the social services. And how long is your how long are you going to be doing this study?
That's a great question. until we find the answer. We're going to be spending at least a couple more months down in Sullivan County, making trips down there. And then once we feel like we have an adequate picture on the ground, then we'll go and start talking to state policymakers, and then end up the last with the federal policymakers, and then go back at the end of all of it back to Sullivan County. So we anticipate being there for a while and talking to a lot of people and getting a lot of material.
Okay, and have you gone to other? You've gone to other counties as well, or
we're focusing on Sullivan County, and we've talked to some folks in Orange County. We're going to do a comparison. What we're doing is really the model that we're taking is taking the insights we learn from people sharing their time in Sullivan County and using it to help understand the data that we've collected, the data the state's collected, you know, these kind of aggregate statistics, what they mean, what are good indicators, if the kinds of patterns that we're seeing in Sullivan are correct and hold more broadly across the state, we should expect to see certain things in the data. So we're going to really do an intensive study of Sullivan. We're going to do a lighter study of Orange County, and then we're going to look at kind of, you know, data sets to see if the kinds of patterns that we've heard about in these places hold more broadly.
It's Jared again. I wonder, since we are kind of getting into the ripple effect and just how many areas of people's lives it touches, from the children of parents who are using, to the school system, to government social services and so on and so forth. And of course, we're aware of the death rate and Narcan being administered. Is there one particular issue, I guess, that stands out as something that really needs to be addressed first in order for things to fall into place? Is there something that the data indicates is in desperate need of a quick fix and would allow other things to kind of be taken care of afterwards?
Well, I think, everyone we've spoken to and all the data indicate that there are not the resources needed to treat the people who are currently dealing with this problem, for people with addictions. So there are not the detox beds, there are not the treatment beds, there are not the length of treatment, there are not the support services once they're done. So I think the biggest glaring problem that we've seen so far, or we've seen right now, is that there just are not enough resources to treat everybody who has needs help. And I think that would be the number one, if we could fix something and if we could bring a bunch of money in, that's, I think, one thing that we would address right away.
Do you foresee the state addressing that issue, possibly getting involved to build more centers or create more infrastructure to give people a place to go or places to go?
So it's it's unclear, in the current crisis, where the money would come from for the state to step in and do that, and it's unclear where resources could be shifted. So at the same time that Sullivan County doesn't have enough beds, New York City has empty beds, right? So how to reallocate resources or to get people the treatment they need in a way that will work for them, I think, is a big kind of question that we're going to have to puzzle through with policymakers to see how resources could be moved around to get to those people who really need it.
It's interesting because a lot of the people that we spoke to said, obviously, something like money would help. Mm-hmm. So nobody was of the idea that, less money would be a good thing. But a lot of people also indicated that in addition to some of these kinds of financial resources, some of the things that they would like from the state and even federal level of government is to just come into places like Sullivan County themselves to see what's going on. Because there was this kind of sense that the upper levels of government are somewhat detached from the problem in Sullivan County. So we got a real sense that it would, in addition to the money, which of course would be helpful, it would be useful if state and federal lawmakers really understood what was happening in the context of these communities and listening to some of the key stakeholders that are there.
That would be lovely if we could get somebody from Governor Cuomo's office to come down. Somebody like that.
Can I ask who you would like to come down and speak to? Because it's one of the things that we were actually working on in the Institute when our Director of External Affairs said, we should go out and we should bring people from Albany into the community. So do you have a sense of who you would like to talk to?
I don't. I don't know if there is even a national drug czar. I've heard calls for such a position. We've had people who've fulfilled that need in the past, but I don't believe, at least to my knowledge, that there is a person on the federal level, let alone the state level, who is kind of in charge of addressing this issue. It's to my eyes, at least, and I'm not looking too closely, certainly not as closely as you two are, but it seems like a problem unto itself that stretches across many different platforms and different, it requires different strategies, whether it's with the social services or it's with treatment centers, private or public. There's just so many different entities that need to get involved that there's no centralized figure that I could put my finger on and name and say that person needs to be more responsible. I think it's just that's part of the problem, really, is that there is no one person to call to task here. It's too much for one person, I think.
That's true. I don't think they do have anybody. I'm not sure. Do they have someone who in New York State?
No, not that I know of. And the folks that we've been talking to have been saying things like, well, we really would like people from this agency or that agency to come down here and listen to the real problems that we're having.
with very concrete things that agencies are doing or failing to do, right? Two agencies have two different sets of guidelines, which puts providers and family members kind of in the crosshairs of a bureaucratic trap that they don't really want to be in or feel that it's helpful to be in.
Yeah, I mean, we have the most experience with the DEA if they're going to get involved, but that's to arrest, you know, dealers more so than help users. So I don't really know if any if we have a department that handles that on a non-criminal level, basically, where people aren't don't have to worry about being prosecuted, but can go to an agency and trust that they will be given the kind of treatment that they are so desperately needing.
Right.
That might be something that you could put into your study for, like, to pass into legislation that they put money in, implement money in that for someone to do just that, or not just one person, maybe a group of people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But to have a clear point person.
Yeah. Yes. That might be something.
Have relevant agency head to come down and listen to what everyone has to say.
Right. That might be if you put that into your study and maybe... if they had money for that, that would be something that Sullivan County would definitely could definitely use.
Okay, we will work on that.
Oh, that would be wonderful. And I do believe we're almost out of time, but I wanted to thank the two of you for speaking on the air with us, and I hope to meet with you again. And I wish you good luck with your study. And thank you for being
on. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being on the Kingfisher with us, and we hope to hear from you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I just want to thank everybody in Sullivan County who's spoken with us. People have been so generous with their time.
Thank you.
And yes, thank you once again to the researchers from the Rockefeller Institute of Government for being with us on the air tonight. If you need to be in touch with them, please be in touch with us through the Kingfisher Project here at WJFF. You could contact us at kingfisherwjff@gmail.com or through our Facebook page, the Kingfisher Project. And we have a couple of announcements for the Kingfisher calendar. First, a video contest. So this is for high schoolers throughout Sullivan County. The Sullivan County Public Health Services Office is seeking 30 to 60 second videos made by and for local teens about the dangers of drug abuse. So this is for teens 9th through 12th grade in a public, private, or home school in Sullivan County. It can be done on your smartphone or a video camera, your iPad. And it's all about the dangers of drug abuse. So the videos can be submitted through a special county-created online portal, and they'll be viewed and judged by public health services staff and members of the Drug Prevention Task Force in Sullivan County. The winning videos will then be featured on the county website and social media pages, including the YouTube channel that the county maintains, and they can also be used as PSAs in local professional media. There'll be a non-monetary award, but made by the legislature after the judging. So video submissions will be accepted now through March 20th. And you can go to the county website to find the link or call this number, and the link could be sent to you. It's 292-5910. And, you know, we'll grab this PS. We'll grab this information and put it onto the Kingfisher Facebook page, so you'll be able to find it there, the Kingfisher Project Facebook page. And also, on coming up on February 22nd, there will be a Narcan training. That's the naloxone overdose reversal training. We could make the difference between life and death. That's going to be given at the Monticello Library, Ethelbert B. Crawford Public Library at 479 Broadway on February 22nd at 6 p.m. There is an announcement of this nature posted on the Kingfisher Facebook page right now. And to give you an idea of what you'll hear that night, let me just repeat the information. We're going to play a clip of Marty Colavito, who is the trainer in Narcan. Once again, that training is happening Thursday, February 22nd at 6 p.m. at the Ethelbert B. Crawford Public Library. They have a community room there. It's at 479 Broadway, and you should register if you would like to be trained in the Narcan overdose reversal. And right now, we're going to hear a little bit from a past training that Marty Colavito had given back in April at the Hurleyville Fire Department, so you can get an idea of what you'll hear on February 22nd.
The physiology of an overdose. The opioid receptors are found in the brain and include the respiratory center and the medulla. An overdose, it represses the urge for us to breathe, and it decreases response to carbon dioxide, leading to respiratory depression and ultimately death. It's the other thing really briefly to understand with addiction. The idea of addiction and how somebody becomes addicted, more and more, the more we study that, the more we realize that ultimately we become addicted to our own body chemistries. We got these little guys that, you know, that are in our brain that produce endorphins. Imagine them with hard hats and pickaxes and stuff, and they make endorphins. They're the guys that if you're a sports fan and your team wins, you jump up and you're ready to go crazy and you're feeling good, you know what I mean? Or if you're a jogger, you want, you have a nice run and you're done, you feel good. Those are those guys at work. And what happens is sometimes we substitute their job with something that's foreign to our body. Opiates, some people can use anything, because that's the nature of addiction. And the nature of addiction is that there's a compulsion involved that drives us to use more and more and more and more. The more we use, the more those guys who produce the endorphins in our bodies take time off and they're gone. All right? So ultimately, once we're addicted and we try to stop, those guys are nowhere to be found. They're nowhere to be found. So we're trying to get a feeling that now physically we can't produce. Hence, us being addicted to the body chemistry that now exists within us. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead. Continuum of an overdose. An overdose is rarely immediate and can happen over 1 to 3 hours. It involves heavy, uncontrollable nodding. You can still be aroused. Snoring, a loud breathing. An overdose is when you're not responsive, very shallow breathing and gurgling. Your skin changes and blue lips and nails can occur. And you could have a fatal overdose. Not every overdose results in a fatality. Okay. Not every overdose results in a fatality. And again, this is going to be a little redundant. This is not very scientific in nature. But the fact of the matter is, what naloxone is going to do, what Narcan, naloxone is the generic name for Narcan. What Narcan is going to do is going to be that thing that intervenes, that buys the person time who is suffering from an overdose to be revived and ultimately and hopefully get treatment. All right, man. The majority of heroin overdoses are witnessed, and it gives an opportunity to provide an intervention. When I was growing up in the city in the Bronx and stuff, and you know, we hang out, you know, most people knew if somebody overdosed. Some people use alone, and that's scary, right? It's one of the precursors to an overdose, one of the symptoms, for lack of a better term. But it rarely do people overdose alone, okay? The fear of police may prevent folks from calling 911, and witnesses may try ineffectual things. There's a lot of myths in regard to this, you know, get somebody up and walking, give them coffee, give them this, do that. A lot of myths, you know. The fact of the matter is there's something physiologically happening. There's something happening, and that if it's not, there isn't an intervention, it could lead to a fatality. Go ahead. What is naloxone or Narcan? It's a medicine that stops the effects of opiates that are intradectable or intranasal. It pushes most other opioids off the receptors and blocks them for 30 to 90 minutes. What it does is, again, the time we're buying is the 30 to 90 minutes. So somebody goes into an overdose, and if we administer naloxone, All right. Hopefully what's going to happen with the first dose is within a couple of minutes. I say 2 to 3 minutes. Some people say 3 to 8. Better safe than sorry. Okay. Somebody's going to be revived. At that point of being revived, do we know what sometimes happens when somebody comes out of an overdose like that? Do we know what could happen? Anybody? Help?
They're angry.
They could be angry. They were very, very comfortable. I was doing outreach on 116th Street and Lenox Avenue in 1979, and a guy overdosed in front of me. And another guy jumped on top of him trying to revive him so he can find out where he bought his dope. Because that's one of the myths. It's the best dope in the world. So you're bringing somebody from that feeling. And pardon my language. I did an Narcan training with some folks and somebody who revived somebody. And when the person was revived, looked at the person, the first words he said was, effing Narcan. Because he was so comfortable within that feeling. All right? So go ahead. Inaction, it reverses the opiate effects of sedatory and respiratory depression, and it causes sudden withdrawal and unpleasant feeling, all right? It lowers the potential for abuse, but is not addictive. So again, what happens is when somebody's coming out of an overdose, chances are they could be a little belligerent. So you got to watch yourself. You got to take care of yourself. Important in any type of first aid, an intervention like this, you need to take care of yourself, because if you're not okay, if you're not safe, then the chances of a positive outcome with the person that we're trying to serve becomes limited. All right? I always talk about this too when I do these trainings. You know, there's this the biggest myth about addiction is that it's like this hovering something that's different than other diseases. But if you stop and think, I was talking to Albie about this before. If you stop and think, when I was a kid, I loved White Castle hamburgers. I remember being a kid saying, my whole life I'm going to eat these every night for dinner, I said to myself when I was 5 years old. You know, and it was a treat if my father would bring them home. Right? And if I did eat them every night, and some kids did, if I did eat fried foods every night, and I love fried foods too, and pizza every night, there's a good possibility that today I would and do need certain forms of medication because I didn't take care of myself. I wasn't contemplative. All right? I was not contemplative. So when somebody is in the throes of addiction, they're pre-contemplative. They're not thinking about the severity of an action. I wasn't thinking of the severity of an action when I was 10 years old, you know, jumping off roofs or riding subway cars. You know what? I said this before, I'll say it again. What could possibly go wrong with riding a subway car or jumping from one elevator to the other one 12 stories high? To a 13-year-old kid, nothing. To a 60-year-old man, a whole lot. So the idea of that child's development comes into play. And the last thing that's developed in our body is the frontal lobe cortex of our brain. And that's responsible for choices, decisions. All right? And with an addict, with this compulsion becomes this override of what is a consequence. What is a consequence? What is a decision? What is a choice? So a lot of times the disease is almost unfairly recognized. It's no different than high blood pressure. Although we'd love to make it that way, we would love to say that it is. I would love to believe that it is. So the stigma that comes with addiction, you know, the stigma that we say, well, that's a choice and they decided to do that to themselves, is based in my fear, in our fear, you know, something we can't control. And the more we address it, the more we study it, the more we buy time, the more we buy time for people, all right, the more apt we are to come to solutions.
And that was the voice of Martin Colavito from Catholic Charities. He is the local trainer in Narcan and Naloxone overdose reversal administration, which is going to be given for the public on February 22nd at the Ethelbert Crawford Library in Monticello. That's going to be at 6 p.m. Go to the Kingfisher page on Facebook and you'll see the flyer there, and you should register for that if you would like to be trained in Narcan, the overdose reversal medication. And that concludes the Kingfisher Project segment of Making Waves for tonight. Up next, photojournalist Rich Klein speaking about his exhibit at the Liberty Museum and Art Center. It's all about firefighters in the Catskills.
And I'm Dan Desmond for WJFS Making Waves. And here in the studio, I have a local photographer, Rich Klein, who's going to be displaying a series of limited edition photographs depicting some of the firefighters of Sullivan County and the Catskills region in the windows of the Liberty Museum and Art Center on Main Street through April 7th, 2018. That's a pretty groovy project, Rich. Really, really excellent, man. I'm really happy about that. So yeah, give us some background here. What's going on with your whole career and everything, how you even got up here, how you got interested in firefighters. Give us the whole story.
Sure. And first of all, thanks for having me, Dan.
Groovy, man.
Yeah, so this exhibit, I've been involved with the Liberty Museum for about a year now.
Excellent.
It started last summer. There was what was called the Bonds of the Catskills exhibit, very well received. We had a lot of people come through there.
Yeah.
And so the people in charge of the museum, during the winter, there's not a lot going on, the winter months, and they came to me and said, why don't we do something with the windows? And I thought about it for a few days, and I had just recently, for the Sullivan County Democrat, where I'm a freelance reporter and photographer, I had shown up at two fires because I listened to the scanner, it's part of my job, and I'd gone out to two fires in Swan Lake and really just observed for a few hours on very bitterly cold days for these guys.
Yeah.
And two very serious fires. And I got a real appreciation for the work. I took a lot of shots, usually only one photo or two makes it into the Democrat, and I had a lot on the roll of the work, you know, their arrival at the scene, going into the scene, coming out of the scene, and sort of the emotional reactions of these firefighters. And one of the cases, somebody's house had been destroyed, and the firefighters from throughout the area, from Liberty, Jeffersonville, White Sulphur Springs, Conanga Lake, I think Monticello was there. You get an appreciation, first of all, for the teamwork and the camaraderie of these guys, as we all know, those of us who live up here. And so in talking to the folks over at the museum, I thought, well, I have these extra photos, and why not honor these unsung heroes of our society and our region?
Excellent, man. So give us a little bit more about your background, how you even got into this, how long you've been up here. Give us more about that stuff.
Sure. So I actually started coming to the Catskills in 1967.
There you go.
Sleepaway camp, Camp Kennybrook in Monticello, and then another camp called Mahoji in Bethel, which was started going there from 69 to 77. I was a mile away from Woodstock. I was 8 years old, very proud of that.
Heard
John Byers over the mountains.
Yeah.
And then when I got divorced in 2006, I was looking for a place up here, and I moved up to Bethel originally, and I've been in Jeffersonville since last summer. In terms of photography, many years ago, I worked as a sports writer here in this region and also further upstate in Ithaca, and I actually worked with some of the best photographers in the country.
There you go.
And so when you're writing sports stories and working with some, literally the best of Gannett, as it was, they won Best of Gannett Award. I was kind of attached to them, watched them in the dark room. You get a great appreciation for the art. And I've always shot as a hobby, but I didn't really do it as a business until about 5 years ago.
Okay.
So, and what triggered that was the idea of doing a book about my hometown in Massapequa, Long Island. So I did a book in 2014 with a classmate. That led to tons of exhibits throughout Nassau County, Long Island for about 2 years straight, every month in different places. I got some great exposure. And then I had the idea, because of loving living up here all these years and shooting stuff anyway, with this gorgeous landscape that we all appreciate, just began thinking, okay, what can I do? What's my next project as a photographer? And I realized that although there had been many books, many photography books, actually many books, I should say, about the Catskills, there hadn't been a photography book about today's, about what what Sullivan County's castles look like in the 21st century.
There you go.
And so I thought I was onto something, and I had started, I had already had a big inventory of photos and went out and tried to make sure that I shot pretty much every town in this county. And in doing that, it was mostly landmarks and landscapes, let's say, and then also some people. And of course, because I'm community-minded and have an appreciation for the firefighters, there's some fire departments in there too, and some people in action as well. One of the things that inspired me, I was happened to be in Rock Hill one day, and what I thought at the time was an accident was actually a training exercise, and I had a whole bunch of firefighters gathered around and got a shot of that. That's in the book actually as well. And so the book came out about in the fall of 2016.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, you got a book here. I mean, can you talk a little bit about
that? Sure. It's called The Catskills of Sullivan County: Photography Journey. It's 100 pages, and really just tries to capture the essence of what this region is today. As a kid, really spending all my summers here. Even when I was back in Long Island the rest of the year, I was flashed back to the beauty of the mountains.
Yeah,
I was literally looking up to the mountains all the time. Growing up on flat Long Island. it always stayed with me, And I also, when I moved here in 2006, my daughter was little at the time. I wanted her to have a place in the country to visit, and I think she got appreciation for the nature as well.
Excellent. So so this book, it's for sale on your website.
Yeah. So if you go on my Facebook page, The Catskills of Sullivan County Photography Journey, or if you do a Google search, The Catskills of Sullivan County Klein, there'll be a link that comes up from Book Baby, which is my publisher. And right now, between now and Friday, if anybody uses the coupon code WJFF, they'll get $5 off on the book.
Well, there you go. WJFF coupon code. I dig that. So, yeah, let's get back to your exhibit at the Liberty Museum.
So it's a small exhibit. It's really just the windows right now. There's about five or six photos that are there, really. And the photos that are exhibited were from two fires that happened to be in Swan Lake. So part of my job at the Sullivan County Democrat is to cover some of these incidents. I listen to the scanner on my iPhone, and if something's nearby, they'll send me out. I'll just go over there myself. And in these two cases, these fires happened in December 2017, and as we all know, there were some bitterly cold days back then.
Yeah, there's.
Hopefully, we're coming out of that. But those days were really cold, and I watched these firefighters work for 2 or 3 hours at a time, and battling the fires, getting water from nearby water sources because there are no hydrants, and really just doing great work. And so, there's one shot in particular of a young firefighter literally like emerging from the scene with his oxygen tanks and very dirty, and he looked like he'd been through a war. And then there's another shot of a guy just kind of kneeling down looking at the destruction of one of the homes. And I tried to capture the emotion of the moment. Very often when we see shots, it's the flames, the kind of cliche shot. I was trying to showcase in my photojournalism work the hard work that these guys go through and the impact it has on them emotionally.
Excellent.
And I think it certainly does, yeah.
Excellent. And also in the book, you get back to the book a little bit.
Yep.
You cover all of, the whole county and, nature and the people. Kevin was like, talk about the eagle. Tell me about the eagle. What's going on
I'm kind of humbled because I'm glad he liked that shot. There's some great eagle photographers. In fact, I think the Stray Cat Gallery and the Dancing Cat is having something this weekend of all eagle, really good eagle photographers. But I do have one that is kind of a funny story. I used to live in Smallwood, and I was talking to some neighbors one day when I was shooting, and the one of the neighbors came up to me and said, there's usually an eagle that flies over here. And this was just really fortuitous. And 5 minutes later, this eagle comes out of its nest and flies overhead. And I just turned the camera up, and I got one spread eagle.
Spread eagle. You got literally. Literally spread eagle. There you go.
You get those moments, and others you just, you look for the time of the day, morning and night to shoot.
And the lighting, all that. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the best time to shoot landscapes is before sunset. And after dusk, say. So.
Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I just I'm glad to be here. I'm a professional photographer in the area of Rich Klein, New York photography, and I do all kinds of photo work. And I also want to just do a shout out to all the great photographers here in the castle.
Eddie Adams, right? You got an affiliation with that.
In fact, it's funny you mentioned I just signed up because I didn't know about it until last year.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm actually hoping to get into that program.
Excellent.
And I just make it because it's like for up to 5 years, you can get into that program.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so wow. It'd be a real honor. Yeah.
Well, good for you, man. I hope you get it, man. I mean, you wouldn't have to travel very far.
Yeah.
You know, it's right here, and they're all out photographing the county just like you've already been doing for years. So that's great. All right, man. So I got a local photographer, Rich Klein, is going to be displaying a series of limited edition photographs. Depicting some of the firefighters of Sullivan County, at the windows of the Liberty Museum and Arts Center on Main Street through April 7th, 2018. So, Rich, yeah, man, thanks so much for coming in. It was definitely groovy.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Anything last minute? Anything you want to add? Nothing?
No, I think that's it.
All right, man. Very, very cool. You have a good night now.
Too.
All right, bye-bye.
And thank you, Dan, for speaking with Rich Klein, photographer. That sounds like a great exhibit over there at the Liberty Museum and Art Center next. We'll be talking with Jeff Doolittle of Eric Banger and the Mashers, the Irish folk band that will be performing at St. John's Episcopal Church in Ellenville on February 22nd at 7:30 p.m. So Dan's going to be talking with Jeff, and take it away, Dan.
All right, back to the studio, and on the phone here we have Eric Banger and the Mashers. Eric, you on the phone? Oh, wait a minute. There we go.
Yes, I'm here. Actually, funny story, I'm not Eric. There is no longer an Eric Banger.
Okay. Well, who are you? Properly introduce yourself, then.
My name is Jeff Doolittle, and I'm the band leader.
Excellent. All right. Can you tell us about the band?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've been playing together for about 6 years at this point. We play almost exclusively Irish traditional folk music, and we are four people at present. Myself, I'm the guitarist and the lead singer. Anastasia Solberg, who plays fiddle. Zach Brandman, who plays mandolin, and my sister Liza Doolittle, who also helps us singing.
Yeah,
Anastasia
is a rather famous violist in the area, if I remember correctly. Isn't that right?
She's a violist.
I've played with her a few times. Excellent. Groovy,
yeah,
man.
Absolutely. Yeah, she runs the MISU, the Music Institute mm-hmm. of Sullivan and Ulster, and we are blessed to have her with us. She really adds a wonderful talent to our lineup.
Wonderful. So, yeah, you guys formed in Newburgh back in 2012. And get into your style of music, your inspiration, and what keeps you going?
Well, I wish we could say that we had like an unbroken, heritage in Irish music. We definitely don't.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, Anastasia and Zach are both Jewish, but we've come to it out of interest more than anything. All of us kind of being united by this interest in the energy of Irish folk music, particularly as performed by groups in the '60s up until today, like the Clancy Brothers, the Dubliners, and more recently the Pogues. So we definitely take a page from their kind of ethic and style, but we are all Americans, so we definitely kind of keep that in mind as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you know, I'm American. I play music written by Beethoven a lot, so it doesn't change it, you know. Yeah, yeah. So that's you know, it shouldn't matter too much. You know, the music is the music. Yeah. But yeah, Irish music has a quite a beat to it, you know, the Beaudron, and it's quite amazing. Do you write any of your own music, or do you play music by certain composers or certain writers?
Well, we try to focus on really researching, I guess, is the best way to put it. We look into the past. We play a lot of really old songs that have been around for in various versions, you know, through the centuries. We don't write anything at this point. We're primarily kind of interested in preservation, I guess, digging into our, you know, not so much archives at this point, but we definitely do dig into some early printed sheet music. Anastasia really kind of helps us on that front. And I'm a historian myself, so I do tend to like filling out the context for some of these older songs. And
medieval history, right? Is that correct?
Yes, actually much older than a lot of the music.
Yeah, sure. What does that, you know, I'm a... just the opposite. I'm a musician, but I'm an historian. I love like history. I'm just absolutely fascinated by history and the impact that it has on who we are today. What does your history bring to your art? I should say, what does your understanding of history bring to your art? I think I should say, especially, you know, medieval history and, Ireland in particular, medieval history of Ireland is quite rich.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that has really what has been sparking, my interest, you know, just seeing the complexity that an apparently very simple song, you know, that to us, you know, sounds just kind of like silly or nursery rhyme-ish. Mm-hmm. You know, when you start to analyze all of the components, like where the melody comes from,
right,
you know, where like the chorus comes from another source, the mm-hmm. verses come from a third source, you know, it is just fascinating to see like how these bits and pieces of a melody or, you know, a particularly strong lyric or whatever, how it kind of translates from language to language, from culture to culture, and across the oceans.
Right.
You know, so, you know, that it's inspiring, and it's absolutely incredible. You know, it's original memes, you know, in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly true. And and it absolutely, you know, music no doubt has the ability to cross language and cultures medieval history with, I love how music kind of formed with the 12 tonal system, the dodecaphonic system that we now have today, that kind of got its roots in medieval times, as well as the writing of music has its roots in medieval times. And I've always found that just so fascinating, the you know, how music came together to you know, over, you know, hundreds of years, centuries, to become what we know of it today. You know,
absolutely. I've had the great fortune last year to spend a few months working directly with manuscripts, and it's fascinating to see that, like, across all different kinds of genres of writing, you will see in the margins little neumes, mm-hmm. little notation for various songs that were in, you know, whoever was reading that book at the time, because it's not in a music book, it's just in like a medicine book, or, you know, who knows, you know, just a little scribble in the margin of a song that someone had in mind, you know, from 1,000 years ago. It's very hard to piece that together, what that actually sounds like without words and, you know, other guides. But it's fascinating just that to see that impulse. You know?
Yeah, that absolutely, truly, truly is amazing. So we got a bit of music here that we'll play. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but Kevin assures me it's quite lovely. Is there anything else that you want to add? You'll be playing at February 22nd at St. John's Episcopal. Is that correct?
Yes. It's at in Ellenville, downtown Ellenville. It's not at the Episcopal Church, but rather the chapel right next to it.
Excellent.
We share the same parking lot there. That's at 40 Market Street in mm-hmm. Ellenville.
Okay.
And the entrance is $5, and bring your own mug.
Okay.
For tea or coffee or other libations that we will have there.
Sure. And you got an ongoing gig. Where is that? In Hyde Park, someplace every St. Patrick's Day.
On St. Patrick's Day we play.
I think that's
every
Saturday
year
this
now,
year, right?
Our inception at Darby O'Gill's. That's at 4 to 7.
Excellent.
On March 17th.
Yeah, I believe that's a Saturday this year, isn't it? I think.
It is. Yeah, we're expecting a rather hectic showing.
Yeah, it should be.
It's always a good time there.
Should be a very fun, very fun evening. Very fun evening.
Yes. Yeah.
So I guess with nothing else to add, we'll close on this piece here that Kevin assures me is quite lovely. So I have Jeff Doolittle of Eric Banger and the Mashers been speaking with today here on WJFS Making Waves. Anything else, Eric?
I would like to just thank Kevin
WJFS
for the support over this past year. You've definitely helped us a lot, and we really appreciate it.
Excellent. Well, it's real good to talk to you, and have a good evening, and keep on playing with the great music.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Good night.
All right, good night. Bye-bye.
News, oh Michael O'Shannon, with your long barrel guns from the sea. Say what wind from the south brings a messenger with the hymn of the dawn of the free. Goodly news, do I bring you the port? Goodly news, shall you hear, body man? For the boys march at dawn from the south to the north, led by Kelly, the boy from Tell me who is that giant with the gold curly hair? He who rides at the head of your band. 7 feet is his height, with some inches to spare, and he looks like a king in command. Army boys, that's the pride of the bold chevaliers, amongst our greatest of heroes of man. Bring your beavers aloft and give three ringing cheers for John Kelly, the boy from Cologne. And his court is in flames, and old Wexford is won, and tomorrow the barrow we will cross. On a hill or a town they have planted a gun that will batter the gateway across. All the fort men and bargemen will march overneath with brave Harvey to lead in the van. Of the foremost of all in that grim will be Kelly, the boy from Cologne. But the gold sun of freedom grew dark in that frost as it set by the Slaney's red wings. And poor Wexford stripped naked on high on a cross, with her heart pierced by traitors and knaves. Glory ho, to her brave sons who died for the cause of the downtrodden man. Glory ho to my Mensters, oh darling, and pride, don't miss Kelly, the boy from Milan.
Thank you very much.
Eric Banger and the Mashers performing on WJFF's Making Waves. Stay tuned next week for more locally produced content. This is WJFF Jeffersonville and W233AH Monticello, where the temperature outside of studios right now is 26 degrees. And the weather for the rest of the day, we can expect to be partly cloudy with lows around 12 degrees. Then Tuesday, mostly sunny with highs near 32 degrees, wind 7 miles per hour.
Support comes from you and from the Honesdale Wellness Center, providing individual, couple, family, and group therapy at 602 Church Street in Honesdale, Pennsylvania. Change your mind and transform your life. HonesdaleWellnessCenter.com.
Now stay tuned for Trailer Talk here on WJFF.